Programming is supported by Topline Construction Firm, your local women-owned roofing contractor based out of Shoreview, Minnesota. Roof replacement, both retail and insurance work. More information at toplineconstructionfirm.com.
All over the country,
we need to improve reading in Wisconsin.
Schools are changing the way they teach reading.
I'm calling for a renewed focus on literacy.
We have gotten this wrong in New York and all across the nation.
And it's happening because of a podcast.
I think your podcast has changed my life.
And I'm going to share this podcast with everyone I meet.
Sold a Story investigates how teaching kids to read went wrong. New episodes of Sold a Story are available now.
You're listening to a recording of a live radio show on NPR News. If you want to listen to us in real time, you can stream our show live weekdays at 11 a.m. Central. Thanks for listening and enjoy the show.
Good morning. I'm Angela Davis, and you're listening to NPR News. Where would we be without the foundations that support the efforts of people who are trying to make Minnesota a better place to live for everyone? Today, we are taking some time to get to know a Minnesotan who is in charge of one of the biggest community foundations in the country and the largest here in Minnesota. I'm talking about Dr. Eric Jolly at the St. Paul and Minnesota Foundation, previously known as Minnesota Philanthropy Partners. Now, the foundation manages nearly $1.5 billion in assets and supports about 2,000 charitable organizations. Eric Jolly was named one of the most admired CEOs by Minneapolis St. Paul Business Journal in 2019, and he's also well known for his work leading the Science Museum of Minnesota for a decade. And Eric Jolly is here in the studio with me this morning to talk about all the work the foundation is doing, as well as his own personal story. Good morning to you.
Good morning. Hi. Thank you for having me.
Nice to see you. So I see on your website that 2020 is the foundation's 80th anniversary, a good time, I think, to really reflect on its contributions to communities across the state. And so how do you begin to describe the impact that the St. Paul and Minnesota Foundation has had over all of these years?
The foundation has amplified the voice and the wishes and the spirit of our community. That's really been the impact. And so it's the impact of a community that's incredibly generous, that has wonderful ambitions to build a sense of unity, of trust, to build a vibrant Minnesota in which all people and communities thrive. And so 80 years ago, one donor, Annie Paper, put forward $5,000. That was the beginning of our foundation. Joining with others, we've, of course, invested this money over and over again. And Annie's $5,000 can be shown to have offered $75,000 worth of impact in these last 80 years. It's been pretty remarkable. Mm-hmm. Throughout our community, in the money that has been given through our donor advice fund partners, the other foundations we work with, and our own work, the St. Paul and Minnesota Foundation has distributed last year, we reached our milestone, 79 years, $1 billion into the well-being of the state and our community.
That's amazing. I would think that you would wake up each morning. Maybe do you feel a lot of pressure, or are you just really grateful that you're in a position to help make decisions?
I wake up full of joy. Mm-hmm. Think about this. I wake up in a community which wants to change the world for the better. And so, yes, it's the tough decisions are saying no to anyone who has a passion to change some part of the world. But the best part is to be able to partner with the many agencies and agents of change who really want to make a difference and are trying to build a legacy for this community based on the generosity of all of our citizens.
So one of the things that the St. Paul and Minnesota Foundation does is that you help fund other foundations. So can you talk about that work?
Certainly. We support 17 community affiliates, everywhere from Zumbrota to Wayzata, Hibbing, Chisholm Community Foundation, and we're helping those communities seed and grow their own local philanthropy so they can support those agents of change that want to make their community better. We also support the entire state, whether it's supporting our nonprofit entities across the state through Catch a Fire, a high-tech volunteer program that gave almost $1.5 million of volunteer time across the entire state to over 300 nonprofits, or Give Min, raise men. You know, Give to the Max Day.
Yes, givemn.org.
That's right, givemn.org. Thank you. That was originated out of the St. Paul and Minnesota Foundation to serve the state.
So what's the point? Are you trying to empower people to just to do more of the good that they're already doing?
We want to inspire generosity, advocate for equity, and invest in community-led solutions. So the first part is, how do we inspire generosity? How do we bring more Minnesotans to the giving table? Well, we do that in a number of ways, through donor advised funds, in which individuals can pool their philanthropy with us and with others, through supporting other foundations like the Bigelow Foundation and the Mardeg Foundation. Or we might inspire generosity through volunteer programs like Catch a Fire that we support. We'll find ways to bring others into the fold. We recently announced we're the only community-based community foundation that offers Sharia-compliant donor advised funds, bringing the Muslim community into the philanthropic circles of Minnesota. And that support has helped bridge community discussions on religion and community building. It's been wonderful. So we seek to inspire generosity, bringing more Minnesotans into our giving community, into our volunteer community. We want to advocate for equity. And the final thing that I've talked about is investing in community-led solutions. And that means...
What does that mean? So someone on a very grassroots level has a great idea.
That's
and
right.
And so you want to...
We want to know, is it an idea that represents the best of the community? All too often, foundations will ask, if we give you money, who will benefit and how much benefit will we measure? We additionally ask, who informed this idea? Who said this was the problem the community wanted addressed? We listen, and we listen humbly to hear, is this the voice of community? And who formed the idea? Is it formed by the community? We don't want solutions to be visited upon people for problems they may not have even realized they had. Mm-hmm. We want to listen to the community, invest in what they say, and try and identify the best of those voices that can lead to the better solutions for their challenges.
I think a great example of some of the work that the St. Paul and Minnesota Foundation does, a good example is the former professional soccer player and St. Paul native Tony Sana.
Yes.
He started a foundation, but it was because the St. Paul and Minnesota Foundation helped him launch it. So he came back home. It's like, hey, I want to, you know, work with kids, get them involved in sports. I want to get involved in what's happening in schools and get more, you know, young people interested in becoming teachers. So what was the connection between helping him get his foundation
there
launched?
Was someone with a passionate idea and a community behind him. He had a following. Mm-hmm. And he had a vision. It was a compelling vision. Others were willing to join in. He started in his basement with volunteers and a very simple sense of what was possible. We helped him establish relationships with donors, build his foundation. We advised him on how to help make that more powerful. And we stayed with him every step along the way as he built it out from three volunteers in his basement to dozens of employees and thousands of students who are impacted by this work every year.
And Tony Sana, he's been a guest on this show. He now, I think he's helping about 13,000 kids a year, and they have a budget of $3.5 million.
Yes.
So does that give you a sense of fulfillment? And would like to see more people maybe do what he was able to do?
Absolutely. We look for those inspired individuals who have a leadership opportunity in their community to do something that matters. And that what matters has to fill the spirit of all of our community, whether it's, you know, we talk about a just, equitable Minnesota. We also talk about a vibrant Minnesota with an art scene that involves all of our community and all people, with education programs that succeed for all. We want to work across multiple sectors to make the whole life of a community member powerfully positive.
There's a quote on the foundation's website. It reads from you, as a leader in our community, we can't do it all, but together we can see that it all gets done. Can you elaborate on that?
Certainly. Long ago, I was asked, what's not working in education? And another foundation commissioned me as a research scientist to look at all the data and see what was working. We found out that education reform generally was focused in one of three areas. It was focused on engagement, getting young people excited, engaged, having a sense of accomplishment, a sense of capacity to do the work, to know what it is to do science. Capacity. How do they get the requisite knowledge and skills to advance to ever more rigorous disciplinary knowledge? That is, if you fail algebra, you're not going to pass calculus. How do we give them the capacity to keep going on? In continuity, are they being coached to move from one area of study to the next? Are they being helped to make the transition to college? If we miss on any one of those three, we fail our young people. There are many organizations that do one, two, some do all three. Each organization can't do it all, but together in partnership, they can see that it all gets done. Our work in the foundation is about forging partnerships, helping to bring together passionate leaders from across different disciplines to solve our problems.
I keep hearing that the philanthropy landscape, the philanthropy scene here in Minnesota is changing. It's changing nationally. What are you seeing as the big shifts? Like, what is changing?
We're seeing more people are concerned with their outcome, with knowing firsthand that the program that they touched in their personal philanthropy mattered, that they can see that they're making a difference. And so it's moving down towards the grassroots. We're also seeing younger people getting engaged in philanthropy mm-hmm. and wanting to do solution-based philanthropy, and they want their solutions now. So that little bit of impatience is actually good for our field.
What do you think that urgency is coming from? That's just the way they live their lives. The
world moves faster today than ever before.
So then what is the challenge then for the work that you're doing in terms of maybe slowing things down and being more reflective? Like, people want to see immediate results.
We want to invest in things that will work. We have to be willing to suffer the failures of investing in things that we hoped would work. And so we need to have some of that venture capital where we know we'll try three things and hope that one of them works. And then we need to amplify solutions that do work. So the foundation is very concerned with gathering data, with looking across the national landscape, identifying working models, and pairing the people in Minnesota who want to create change with that national vision, and then supporting it, both through our own resources, our unrestricted and field of interest funds, and by introducing them to the donors who hold donor-advised funds for the betterment of our community.
If you're just joining us, we're talking to the president and the CEO of the St. Paul and Minnesota Foundation, Dr. Eric Jolly, the foundation celebrating 80-year history here in Minnesota, and the work that it's doing and funding other organizations that are working to make Minnesota a great place to live for all of us. And so if you have a question, give us a call. The number is 651-227-6000. You can also leave me a message on Twitter. I'm at Angela Davis, MPR. About 5 years ago, you came to the foundation, and in your previous job, and that may be where people still know you from, you were the president of the Science Museum of Minnesota, a place that many people have had an opportunity to visit, children and adults. And you came to the Science Museum partly because you're a scientist, right?
Yes.
So tell me about your educational background and all the many fields that you've studied.
So I've benefited from a life that hasn't been overwhelmed by a sharp focus. And so my early undergraduate training was in physics, electrical engineering, and psychology. My master's was in mathematics with a focus on psychometrics, which is statistics of human measurement. And then I did my doctorate in cognitive science and cognitive psychology and tried to understand how to build computer models of the brain as well as how to create pathways to understand human interactions and memory.
And so at the Science Museum of Minnesota, you were there, I think, for 11 years?
Yes.
What did you enjoy about that work, being the top leader of the museum?
I worked with the most magnificent people. They were incredibly creative in building exhibits and producing films, to passionate about the education and programming that we provided. During my time, those leaders helped move us into being the number one exhibit construction company in the nation, and we helped to create a national dialogue on significant issues, such as an exhibit on learning, an exhibit on race, Are We So Different, that we toured around the country. We helped produce films that went to over 400 screens in 22 countries as the major film producer in the science museum industry. We created education and teacher training programs, and the science museum became the leading teacher professional development provider in science in the entire state. It was an ability to use those platforms to advance the quality of life for all of our Minnesotans and make science something that served and excited us.
Yeah, the race exhibit, that is one that I think if people had a chance to see that, it was extremely interactive, very impactful. And again, it traveled the country. Talk about, why was it important to you to have that here in St. Paul and have children and adults have an opportunity to see that?
One of our great challenges in this nation is going to be, how do we address building one community from many cultures? That doesn't mean giving up these cultures, but it means entering all of us into a single community bond that understands how we can serve each other. Race is a great divide. We use this exhibit to help people understand that the divide is social, not real. We looked at the bad science that created an idea of race to begin with. There is no genetic idea of race that is defensible. And then we looked at the new social science that understood the enduring impact of the construct of race and tried to help understand what that legacy was in housing, education, and health as three key factors. So we gave people a chance to understand that we were victims of a bad science that created a eugenics movement that pushed the notion that we were different, and that under investigation, we are not. But we have social differences that were amplified by this history, and we can hold on to the social differences that we value as our culture, but we have to let go of those that keep us from building community.
What was some of the feedback you received from the race exhibit?
I was fond of saying, because for the Science Museum, we had a goal of renting these exhibits out to help us build the next great exhibit. For this one, we had three traveling simultaneously around the United States. I would say, with tongue in cheek, we got enough death threats to make the exhibit credible, but not enough credible death threats to make it dangerous.
Why death threats?
We challenge people's notions. And for some people who are still involved in racial superiority organizations, this was a challenge to the very being of how they understood themselves.
Because of the science of race.
Because the science was undeniable. And let me say that more than anything else, that's not what we got. More than any, our feedback was joyful recognition that I, too, am in this exhibit. I remember grandfather calling up his grandchildren, saying, "You have to come. I'm going to stay here. I'm sending a cab to pick you up. I want to show you this. You've never seen it before." And his young African-American grandchildren saw themselves expressed powerfully in this exhibit.
You're known for your passion for STEM education, science, technology, mathematics, engineering, and trying to get more young people excited about it and seeing themselves as having careers in that. Where does that come from, and why are you?
So I'm a first generation high school student. Neither of my parents made it that far, but they did everything they could to organize the world that I would succeed in high school. And they couldn't have imagined college, but when they heard that I could go, they did everything they could to support that. And I have learned that education is a liberating force in human development. Education, once given, can't be taken away. It is a legacy that is transmitted across generations. If you have graduated high school, it's very likely that you will see that your children graduate high school. And the same is true for college. Mm-hmm. And so I believe education is an incredible force. And I think science is, for many of us, the literacy of the future. It is an essential literacy unlike anything we've confronted before, whether it's the science we carry in our iPhones and in our back pocket, or the science that's required to learn how to master a car where you used to simply roll up a window and let out a clutch pedal.
And you also have an interest in making some progress in addressing the country's achievement gap, and particularly what we're seeing here in Minnesota with the achievement gap. So what role do you think science can play in that, and if we get young kids interested and curious about science?
So science is a wonderful way for young people to see how to construct their own world and how to change it. I'm going to digress, if you'll let me, for a moment. When we talk about science, people often have asked me, what is science? And I tell them, science isn't a thing. It doesn't come in a box. Foss-Kits are not an exception. Science is a process. It's a wondrous process in which you develop a theory, you test a theory, and you revise or reject your theory. And so if you're still with me, the next big issue is then, what's theory? Theories are fundamental to science. Well, theories are tools that do three powerful things. They do many things, but they organize existing knowledge. They predict new knowledge, which is so exciting to uncover. And so they organize, predict, and they explain in some aesthetic sense the sum of the whole. A great theory is a beautiful story. And when you can be part of writing that story, of uncovering and predicting new things, that's a wondrous path for a young person to go somewhere that no one has ever explored.
Were you like this as a child? Because you're smiling as you talk about science.
Yes. I'm the one who I was the finalist at the International Science and Engineering Fair. I was the one who developed smoke bombs in my parents' basement. Oh, my poor parents. And I've always been excited about creating in science and engineering.
And so your family is Native American.
Yes.
And so did that make your experience as a student who loves science any different from some of the other students?
Well, you know, I could go into the history of where it was challenging, but I'd rather tell you that I came from a family of storytellers. And so I understood the fundamentals of building a good theory. And knowing that connecting my storytelling or my basket making to my science was incredible. And so my early study in physics was long after my early study in how to weave baskets. And if you weave baskets, you learn to soak the reed, you learn the stress you can put on the reed, and you learn when it will break. You learn how to dye the reed, and whether you use natural materials or chemicals, whether it will soak through the fiber of the reed or not. In other words, you learn about shear compression and torsional stress, an elastic limit, Hooke's law, the difference between absorption and adsorption, dialysis and osmosis, all these words that I knew in Cherokee before I knew they were words of science. And so my culture helped me see that I was already comfortable in those things of science. My training taught me the English words that gained the respect for that science.
Who taught you how to weave baskets?
I learned with my mother and grandmother, but most of my work was with Mavis Doring, who was the most famous basket weaver in the Cherokee Nation's history. And Mavis taught me basketry and helped me introduce me to the art community of the American Indian communities.
And you, a basket that you wove is actually on exhibit at the Smithsonian's National Museum of the American Indian in Washington, D.C.
I don't know if it's on exhibit right now. It was acquired by the Smithsonian before there was the National Museum of the American Indian. And so it's been on display in the museums of art.
So you're pretty good.
Yes, I enjoyed it. I had a career as a basket weaver. Right. I have had shows at the Swope, the Quisenberry, the Rhode Island School of Design. There's a current exhibit of my work in a museum in Nebraska. I enjoyed it. It was a great phase of my life.
I like that you're describing what you were doing. And so that's obviously an art form, but how that weaves together science. If we think of I think sometimes we think make things more complicated than they really need to be.
Mm-hmm. Science is, I hear people say math is hard. No. Math is challenging, and that challenge isn't hard. It's a joy if you can engage in it, if you can see at the end I've solved a problem. And yes, I've always tied it together. We make things much more complicated than weaving a basket. But if you can weave a basket and understand why, you'll pass high school physics.
and go on to do great things, as you have done. If you're just joining us, we are talking to Eric Jolly, the president and CEO of the St. Paul and Minnesota Foundation. And Eric is a lifelong educator, a scientist, a storyteller, a basket weaver. This hour, we're talking to him about his life and the foundation he now leads, which is marking its 80th anniversary this year. We're taking your phone calls, too. Do you have a question about the St. Paul and Minnesota Foundation and how it works, how it may be of service to you? You can give us a call at 651-227-6000 or tweet me at Angela Davis, NPR. And Eric, we are talking about some of the programs and other foundations that the St. Paul and Minnesota Foundation helps fund. And I know that in 2020, housing is on your radar. So talk to me about what the foundation is trying to do, wants to do, is doing when we look at affordable housing and emergency housing across Minnesota.
We've been building our muscle to work in housing, and we've been in that area for a long time, but it's really accelerating now. Last year, we started partnering with the counties and looking at redirecting uses of shelters into housing. We've been a major supporter of the Catholic Charities of Minnesota in getting their shelters ready and moving people from shelters into housing. We are home for the governor's fund for Minnesota homelessness, and that's growing rapidly. We've started moving our work in what are called program-related investments, and so we're offering subsidized low-income loans to places like the Common Bond communities to help them build and retain affordable housing. We're also working with Sunrise Banks and doing loan guarantees so that people who may not otherwise have easy access to financing affordable entry-level housing can gain access to it. We're very involved in moving Minnesota from a state that worries about an emergency shelter. Shelter's essential. Shelters save lives, but they don't build homes. Houses do. How do we create homes? Homes for families, homes for children, homes for individuals to build and contribute to our community. We're very involved in this.
And what have you seen in terms of the differences in rural communities across Minnesota and what we see here in the Twin Cities metro area as it comes to the housing crisis?
Rural communities seem to have less experience historically with dealing with concerns about shelter and emergency shelter. But they have seen that as a growing problem, and they continue to see finding available housing as a problem. Housing is not a rural-urban divide. It is a problem across all of Minnesota. And when we can increase affordable housing in greater Minnesota, we are sometimes challenged that we're also further from jobs. So we have to increase transportation as well, or we make affordable housing unaffordable transportation. And together we have to help greater Minnesota address their housing and their transportation needs as much as we have to address them here. They're not significantly different. They are different in the level of scale and in the level of access that we have to seeing people who are on the streets in the Twin Cities. Mm. It doesn't mean they aren't there, whether it's in Moorhead. I was up at Fargo Moorhead and watching people march across the bridge to get meals on one side and shelter on another. Because homelessness doesn't have a boundary, and neither does hunger.
As a child, what do you feel like you can connect to what some families are experiencing? Because in your own childhood, your family, you grew up in a home that was low income. Is that correct?
That's right.
So do you have I sense a personal connection as you speak of this?
I do. Our family helped build each other's homes. And that was a great gift that we were able to give to each other. I came from a large family, and so we could convene nearly 100 or more cousins. I have 150 first cousins. So it was easy to say we're having a build. But my first home did not have plumbing. That was outdoors. And I'm not that old. You can tell from my voice, I hope, listeners. But I understand that housing gives you a place to feel safe, a place to learn, and a place to rejuvenate and heal. And that's an important part about giving people dignity. And more than anything else, housing helps people build dignity. And secondarily, it also helps them contribute to community and give back to others.
I want to bring in one of our listeners. We're talking to Dr. Eric Jolly, the president and CEO of the St. Paul in Minnesota Foundation, about the work the foundation does and his own personal story. And in St. Paul, we have Glenn on the phone. Good morning, Glenn.
Good morning.
Hi, go right ahead.
Okay, well, as I mentioned to the screener, I'm staying at Catholic Charities Higher Ground Shelter right now in St. Paul. And I want to compliment them. They're doing wonderful work. They added a lot of beds this year. It keeps on growing. And, you know, it's unfortunate that it keeps on growing, but it's there for more people now than before, even.
Glenn, thank you so much for calling in. I think it's really important for all of us as Minnesotans to know we go through times when having access to a shelter is the best way for us to look forward in our lives. Could you tell me a little more about that for you?
Well, certainly, sir. Personally, I've lived the majority of my adult years nomadic, I could say. 4 years on a sailboat, 4 years out of a pickup truck, and then 4 years just hitchhiking and taking buses. That I got very comfortable on the boat being semi-hermitic. There were months that I had, still was keeping track of every penny, the accountant training, but and I spent $10 on gas, and I spent $12 on postage this month. It was very informative for me to have that kind of experience. But I'm too old for that now, and I much prefer having a space inside.
Well, I'm glad that we have a community that can make that available to you and help us bring others in from the outside. Thank you so much.
Thanks for calling in, Glenn. And that's Glenn there in St. Paul. And it's when you hear these stories of people who are struggling and are relying on agencies like Catholic Charities and other organizations that the St. Paul in Minnesota Foundation supports, does it impact you? I mean, again, having this job that you have as the leader of the foundation, you're making decisions about that will impact people like Glenn.
So it does in many ways. One of the bright parts of the foundation, and there are so many, is something we call the Community Sharing Fund. The Community Sharing Fund is a fund that we ask our community to help replenish every year, and wonderful, incredible donors do. It's a fund that I talk about as it's the stop the heartbreak. When I was a young man and I was a volunteer at a community action agency, we were stuffing our food baskets and we ran out of food before we ran out of people on the list. And as an ideal list and a young college student, I took out my credit card and I maxed it out and everyone got a meal and I was broke for a very long time. And I thought, oh my, how could I ever be a social worker and face this daily without bankrupting my family? And I thought, how do we help this challenge? Well, today, if a social worker or a community agency learns about one of their clients who is facing a problem for which there is no programmatic solution, let's imagine a single parent whose car needs a new battery. Mm-hmm. And without that, they won't get to work. And without work, they won't have a paycheck. Without a paycheck, they won't make the rent. They're already a little behind. Without the rent, they'll be evicted, and suddenly their child will drop out of the school system they're in and move on to another one. It is heartbreaking. There are no programs for car batteries except our Community Sharing Fund. Those agencies, not the individuals, the agencies can contact us, and over 120 of them do. And we assure that a social worker doesn't go home with a problem they couldn't solve because of $100 here or $50 there. That's what we get to do. And gathering those stories, seeing that impact, makes the burden of these decisions all worth bearing. And I must say, it is an incredible staff that bears them with me. It's not me. I get to represent some brilliant, generous people.
I want to talk to another one of our listeners in St. Paul. David is listening this morning. And David, you have a question or a comment for Eric Jolly at the St. Paul and Minnesota Foundation?
Yeah, good morning.
Hi.
More of a comment, I think. You know, I've worked in the nonprofit world, typically almost 100% grant funded. So kind of making the case to philanthropies and why my work was worthwhile. And philanthropies do a lot of good in the community, but my question or comment, I guess, is about sort of what I see as a big crisis in the whole philanthropic model. It seems to me that we're asking more and more of the social problems in our communities to be addressed through stopgaps or Band-Aids funded by philanthropy, but really that can't transform communities very easily in the way that to address like the really huge problems that we're seeing now, whether it's from climate change or huge disparities in wealth, or you know, we're basically providing emergency housing but not building affordable housing. So I'd love to hear your comments about that.
All right, that's David in St. Paul. Thank you, David.
Well, David, as I said, we've leaned into affordable housing as an example by getting partners like Sunrise Banks, an incredibly wonderful partner who with Aon is helping us. We're working with them and they're building for the community 600 units of affordable low-income housing. We've advocated at the Ford site to be certain that a percentage of those are Section 8 eligible support housing as well. I think you've put your finger on a very clear problem, and that is foundations in the nonprofit sector can create models to solve problems, but we need to work together with policymakers to assure that public policy, that public dollars, take good solutions and amplify them for the well-being of all of our citizens. That's not what we can do. We can't fund education. We shouldn't. That's a constitutionally mandated requirement of our government. Funding education is essential. We need to understand that there's other things that are essential and convince our policymakers and our leaders at all levels of government to join in to help build a community where all people and communities thrive.
Eric, I'm curious about why you've chosen to stay in Minnesota. You told me you grew up in Oklahoma and Rhode Island. I know you've worked in Massachusetts. And you said when you came to Minnesota, you're like, yeah, I'll be here 3 years. It's been longer than that.
It was 18 years ago. Yeah. I fell in love. I fell in love with the people, the community, the optimism, the welcoming nature. They're a town small enough to warm my soul with communities large enough to provide access to everything I could ever want. This is a community that richly enjoys life, having the second most number of theater seats per capita than anywhere outside of Broadway, the second most in downtown and the Twin Cities, the second most number of faculty and student seats than anywhere outside of Cambridge. We appreciate education, arts, community, family. It's a warm and generous place, and that warmth makes out for the cold that's outdoors, and I learned to embrace that cold by doing dog sledding and enjoying winter carnival. So there's a lot here to love about Minnesota, but mostly it's the people. And once you get a taste of that value, it's so consistent, you don't want to leave it.
I came in the early 90s with the idea I'd be here 2 years, and that was 25 years ago. But I do, though, see it. There is a disconnect here between the haves and the have-nots. And maybe that's in every state in the country. But what are your feelings about, you know, like the disparities, the racial disparities that we have here? And it's in health, it's in education, it's in everything. What is your read on why we do have these huge gaps? Because it's been described in many ways. It's like you have two Minnesota's, or like the tale of two cities has been described. What are your views on that?
I've heard many different perspectives. I have one of those perspectives that I hold, and it may not be the right one, but I believe that life was pretty successful here in Minnesota 40, 50, 60 years ago. there was trauma. There was the destruction of the Rondo communities and others. But it was easy not to see the disparities as they grew. Easy to turn your back on them because there was so much prosperity. And now we have to make certain that we face them straight on, that we acknowledge them, that we enumerate them, that we research them, that we identify where they are. We have among the highest achieving educational sectors in the nation and the largest disparities between black and whites in the nation in education. That means we know how to teach. And somewhere, someone's chosen not to. We can't allow that, and we have to give voice to the truth. The first step towards justice, there are many, but a first step towards justice is the courageous recognition of injustice. And that courage has to come not from those who are oppressed, but from those who have the means to confront that oppression, who have the power and the influence. They need to show the will. And more I'm seeing that will come up. Our governor and lieutenant governor are standing up to the issues of homelessness. We now need our entire community, legislative, business, and others, to deal with it just as well. Itasca has started a housing task force. Business is looking at this. We have to courageously recognize the injustice in education, in criminal justice and its application, in housing and its access. If we do that, we can be a Minnesota to be proud of.
You mentioned the criminal justice system. So I know that one of the agencies that the St. Paul and Minnesota Foundation supports is the Reentry Clinic. And that is a program that provides free legal aid to people after prison or those who have criminal records. Can you tell me more about the Reentry Clinic? What is that? How does it work?
So the Reentry Clinic provides all kinds of legal advice. And sometimes it doesn't have to be to the letter of meeting legal. It can be social advice. It's how does someone reentering society gain access to affordable housing and deal with conflicts with a landlord? How do they deal with conflicts at work? How do they work towards other programs that will help them find affordable housing, a job that's reliable, a chance, a second chance, an opportunity for education? That's what the Reentry Clinic funds. We work with many other organizations. We work with the Reentry Clinic. We also work with Ujamaa Place. How do we lay the foundation for great reentry?
Tell me more about Ujamaa Place. I know that's a nonprofit in St. Paul.
And Ujamaa Place is a nonprofit in St. Paul that provides an interim step from being released from jail or prison to becoming what they call an Ujamaa man. This is forging an identity of dignity, of compassion, of strength, and of capacity to positively impact your community. Those who go through an Ujamaa Place reentry are incredible citizens that we want to welcome back. We need to work with Ujamaa Place and with the Reentry Clinic and with policymakers to reduce the barriers to successful reentry into our community. We have to welcome back our new citizens. And that means we need to look at reducing our parole time. Probation time is so long in Minnesota, and there's been a movement to shorten that and abbreviate it, and that's really good. But we have to also look, where can we reduce the required disclosure for job applications? How can we not have someone lose access to affordable housing because 15 years ago they committed an act that they deeply regret and have served their time? More of our people are coming back. It's not violent crime. It's crimes that were an error. And we need to help people reenter. We need to understand that nearly 80% of people currently in our jails are pre-adjudication or for parole violation revocation. It's not for a crime they just committed. That's not how we want to build Minnesota. That's not Minnesota at its nicest. And we're going to work with Reentry Clinics, Ujamaa Place, and anyone, including our wonderful county attorney, John Choi. here in Ramsey County, who is helping with expungement. When the crime was nonviolent and you've done the time and you've had distance and you've put your life back on track, you may not have an extra $300 to pay for an expungement that others who come from greater means would. And he's made that accessible to people.
As we talk about the work of the St. Paul and Minnesota Foundation and the access to money that you all have, I think I read that, is it $100 million is what the foundation has distributed in grants?
We annually give away with our partners between $80 and $100 million in grants, yes.
So if I'm listening to this conversation and I have an idea, or I'm doing some work and I'm like, if I just had some funding, I could really take it to the next level. How do I access you? Like, how do I tap into what the St. Paul and Minnesota Foundation is doing?
Well, the first thing would be get your idea captured. Make it full. Make it rich. Affiliate with a nonprofit who can make the application. Get online. We have two funding cycles per year. And see what our successful grants look like. See how an idea is built. Mm. Be certain that your work is a priority for the community you want to impact, that the community is a partner in building that idea, and then tell us that story. Know that we get far more in requests than we can ever support. And that's the saddest day of my life, is to look at our declines. And the happiest day is to look at our acceptances, because those are the people who we believe we can give a big chance to make our community better. They have a passion to change the world or whatever part they're working on, and we want to invest in it.
And is it common if someone is, you know, doesn't get their grant request accepted, that they keep trying? Do you encourage people, like, you know, work on your proposal, try again, come at it again? Does that work out sometimes?
Absolutely.
For people?
Absolutely. I once was in the leadership of an international nonprofit organization. We're completely soft money funded, which means grant money only. $132 million a year, and most of it came from organizations that funded an average of 17% of their applicants. So it took us far more than one grant each time. We would do it over and over again until we got it right. We'd listen to feedback, we'd create a bigger network until we finally found that we could get a vision that we shared with our funders.
And that decision-making process, too, it's always by committee. It's not like a handful of people decide yes, no. It's
right.
Way more complicated than that.
It's far more complicated, which is why it takes so much time. But we want the community involved. We have not just our board, but members from the community, members from the nonprofit sector who help us look at these decisions. We have a well-trained staff that sets them up for success and represents the ideas as best we can. And we'll make calls to other partners to say, oh, here's an idea. What do you think of it? We vet them well.
So in our last minute, as you look at 2020, what would you like to be able to call, like, your success story for 2020? What's something that is a priority to you that you would really like to see the foundation really do something great with in this year?
We want to help build stronger and better nonprofit sectors in a variety of ways, both in the way in which we help them with their own endowments and in the way we help them connect to sophisticated donors with more complicated means of giving, such as Bitcoin or appreciated property. We want to help the nonprofit sector grow, and we hope, for my dream, that we'll grow it in areas that will create equitable, just, and vibrant Minnesota and address those issues of equity, confronting them straight on, so that we can say this year we've made progress on homelessness, on criminal justice reform, and on addressing the education achievement gap in Minnesota.
We'll talk again in a year, and we'll see how it goes.
Thank
you.
I'll
see you before then, but thank you.
Thank you.
Dr. Eric Jolly, the president and CEO of the St. Paul and Minnesota Foundation, thank you for your time and all of your great stories.
You just heard a recording of a live radio show on NPR News. To add your voice to the conversation, you can call in at 651-227-6000 or tweet us at Angela Davis MPR. And if you miss us live, you'll find all of our shows by subscribing to this podcast. You can send us your questions or comments by emailing talk@mpr.org.